Ozzie Davis performance on July 3rd, 1965 at Camp Lakeland and Camp Kinderland.
Thank you. Don't keep that up. You'll get hot. I'm happy to be here on the eve of the 4th of July because it pleases me, as I'm sure it should please you, to remember that the American Revolution was not fought only by white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. There were Jews in that battle also. Do you remember that? Anybody told you that? There were also Negroes who fought in the American Revolution. Now, the reason was they all believed what the Declaration of Independence said, freedom for everybody. And, of course, George Washington was a gentleman from Virginia, and in the beginning, he didn't want just anybody fighting his revolution. But when things got tough, he called on everybody, Jews, Negroes included, and they all pitched in and won the revolution. So I think that we should give George Washington a big hand for having so much common sense way back there.
Thank you, George.
And, of course, the revolution wasn't the only thing in which we were all involved. The whole history of our country really is an integrated history. They just don't write it that way. But it was that way. Now, recently, a thing has happened which I'm sure has excited you as it has excited me. And it's excited me because there may be some jobs in it for me. There's a book out now about Negro cowboys. And America has suddenly discovered that the West, when it was being tamed, was not only tamed by white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, it was tamed by Jews, by Chinese, and by Negroes. They were all there taming the West at the same time. Now, they suddenly discover that there were Negroes, and I think that we're going to have some television shows with integrated cowboys. They will ride down an integrated trail into an integrated town and get off their integrated horse. And since I haven't got a job with the Defenders anymore, I wouldn't mind being that integrated cowboy. I have a special welcome for the younger generation from Kinderland who just came in today, and I want to extend the camp's welcome to you. I know how important young people are, because in spite of the fact that eventually they'll get up and grow to be old people, I love them nonetheless. So my personal welcome to all the young people and Kinderland. Now, I can never do a program these days without explaining, first of all, where is my wife? It's because we've worked together for such a long time that people associate us together. Last year I came and my wife wasn't with me, and I got by with it. Now tonight here I am again, and people are looking at me with that that peculiar look in their eyes and said, well now, where is your wife? Well, I'll explain it to you. Ruby is tonight doing Taming of the Shrew at Stratford. So she couldn't come tonight. I had to come out by myself. Now, speaking of that reminds me of the fact that she's been rehearsing Shakespeare since January the 4th. She left home to go to make the rehearsals January 4th. And when she came back, I said, honey, what did you study today? How was it studying Shakespeare? She said, well, we didn't study Shakespeare today. I said, well, what did you study? She said, we studied judo. This was true. This was the first thing they taught my wife when she went to study Shakespeare, was judo. So since that time, whatever criticisms I might have had of her performance, or whatever criticism I might have felt about her being away from home sometimes, and the criticism I might feel tonight about her not being here with me, I keep my mouth shut because Ruby knows judo. Now, a lot of people have said, Ossie, you are a very fortunate man, and I'm very happy with you. I'm so pleased because you exemplify in the Negro people that kind of love, that romantic love for a woman, which is so good for us to see. You and Ruby have been together a long time. It looks like you're going to stay together, and it's very good for our young people to see these two romantically inclined people of our own race. And I say, yeah, that's true. But really what I don't tell them is that there was a different motive behind Ruby and me ever getting together in the first place. And if you won't tell, I'll tell you exactly what was on my mind when I got married. We had been together in a show called Jeb. It lasted 9 performances. Then she got hired to do Anna Lucasta, and I got hired to do Anna Lucasta also. We went all the way across the country, Ruby and I, doing Anna Lucasta. Now, Ruby wanted to be an actress. I wanted to be a writer. I was just doing Anna Lucasta to make enough money to go and study writing at the end of the tour. So I saved my money. And at the end of the tour, I had a little change, you know, about $2,000 that I had saved up by hook or by crook. Now, mostly by crook. Now, when we went from Bridgeport, Connecticut, all the way out to Los Angeles. Now, at the end of the tour in Los Angeles, Ruby left to come back to New York. I stayed on because the tour was extended so we could go to Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington. I wanted the extra money, so I stayed on. Ruby left the company in Los Angeles and came back to New York because they were producing a motion picture. And it was Negroes who were producing the picture. And Ruby always believed that we should invest in our own films. And I thought this was a good idea, too. So she took her money, came back home, and invested in the film, and she was in the film. It was a real picture called The Fight Never Ends. It had Joe Louis, several other people. It was a very good film. So when I came back, we weren't flying in those days. I got off the train at Grand Central, and who should meet me at the station but Ruby Dee. And I was happy to see Ruby. We were friendly, and she was happy to see me. And after a while, she told me what her purpose in coming down to the train station was. She said, "Now, we have almost got the picture in the can, but we need a little more money. I would like, now, you know how I feel about Negroes investing in motion pictures. If we're ever going to be stars, if we're ever going to be up in the big time, we got to put our own money in, right?" I said, "Right." She said, "Well, if that's the way you feel, let me have your $2,000 because that's all we need to get the picture off the ground." Ruby's a very persuasive person because as much as I loved the $2,000, before I left Grand Central, I had given it to her. Well, strangely enough, in about 3 or 4 days, word came through that the picture was finished indeed. But when they sent it to the lab impounded it because of back debt that the producer had. In other words, the whole venture went down the drain. And there I was, after all that year and a half hard work, with nothing. And my $2,000 was gone. Ruby came to tell me the sad news. She said, "Well, this is the chance we take when we produce. This is the chance we take when we invest. And I guess there's nothing." She said, "The money's all gone. I'm very sorry, but I guess there's nothing I can do about it." So I said, "Hold on, Ruby, hold on a minute. There is something you can do about my $2,000. She said, "What is that?" I said, "You can marry me and let me protect my investment." So that's how I got married. It wasn't love of Ruby, it was love of money. And anytime she wants to get free, if she comes up with $2,000, she can go. That's funny, but it's also a little true. I mean, we did grow rather fond of each other, but it all started out with money, believe me. And it's that way now. I was thinking of something to do, something that would have a great moral lesson for these youngsters from Kindleland. Some strong story, something to teach them what the values of life are. I thought of this great poem. Since we're talking about love, a Langston Hughes poem about a young man who loved about as I loved, had a great passion, and who even was tempted to give his life. The poem goes something like this: "I went down to the river, and I sat down on the bank. I thought about my baby, and I jumped in and sank. I went down once and hollered. I went down twice and cried. And if it hadn't been so cold down there, I might have sunk and died.
But it was cold in that water. It was cold. I took the elevator, 16 floors above the ground, and thought about my baby and thought that I had jumped down. I looked down once and hollered. I looked down twice and cried. And if it hadn't been so high up there, why, I would have jumped and died. But it was high up there. Oh, yes, it was high. So you see, I am still living. And I guess I will live on. Now, I might have died for love, but for living, I was born. And though you may see me holler, though you may hear me cry, I will be dog, sweet baby, if you're going to see me die. Life is fine. Fine as wine. Life is fine. That's from Langston Hughes. And here is a moral, not only for the younger people, but for the older heads. A very short poem that goes like this. One night in late October, when I was far from sober, but bearing of my load with manly pride, my feet began to stutter, and I lay down in the gutter. And a pig came up and lay down by my side. A lady passing by was heard to say, "You can tell a man who boozes by the company he chooses." And the pig got up and slowly walked away. Another great moral adventure comes in the form of an African folk tale, a Hottentot folk tale, and it goes something like this. The elephant and the rain had a bit of dispute, and the rain said, "Elephant, since you say that I don't nourish you, I'll go away. I'll leave the jungle, and everything will dry up, and you will die." So the rain left, and pretty soon everything did dry up, and there was only one lagoon left in the whole jungle, and the elephant, being the biggest man about, took that lagoon for himself. One day, the elephant decided to go hunting. So he said to this turtle, who was doing some housework for him at the time, "Turtle, I'm going hunting. I want you to stay and watch my lagoon. Now, I don't care who comes and asks you for a drink of water, you must tell them, no, the water belonged to the elephant. You understand?" "I understand," said the turtle. So the elephant took his gun, went off into the jungles to hunt. After a while, the giraffe came by. Turtle, "I'm awful thirsty. Turtle, how about a drink of that lagoon water?" The turtle said, I'm sorry, giraffe, old boy, the water belongs to the elephant." Zebra came by. Turtle, "I'm awful thirsty. How about a drink of the lagoon water?" Sorry, Zeb, old boy, the water belongs to the elephant." Jim's bark came, the Rudy bark came, the spring bark came, the hyenas came, the jackal came, all the animals in the jungle came down, nearly all of them, to ask for a drink of water, but the turtle gave them all the same answer. I'm sorry, boys, the water belongs to the elephant." But finally the lion came. The lion said, "Hey, you." And the turtle said, "You don't. I'm sorry, Mr. Lion, but you see, the water belongs to the elephant, and the elephant took. But before the turtle could finish it, the lion up and gave him such a whop across his head, it knocked him 200 or 300 feet into the jungle thicket. And by the time the turtle got himself together and crawled back to the lagoon, not only the lion, but all the other animals in the jungle had drunk. And as a consequence, all the water was gone. And just then, the elephant came back. It had been a bad day, a hot day, and he hadn't shot a thing, and he was hot and hungry and evil and thirsty. And he came down to his lagoon, and lo and behold, what do you think he saw? Nothing. Turtle, what happened to my lagoon? Turtle said, "Well, Mr. Elephant, you see, the lion come by, and he was talking politics to me, Goldwater and all that stuff, and I got into an argument with him, and we stepped aside to settle the argument, and by the time we got back, all the animals had drunk of the water." The elephant was outraged. He stormed, he stomped, he shouted. Finally, he was so mad, he grabbed up the turtle and said, "Turtle, you know what the score is, don't you?" Yes, sir, Mr. Elephant, I know. So how do you want it? How do you want it? Shall I just chew you up and spit you, or swallow you down whole?" And the turtle thought for a moment and said, "Well, Mr. Elephant, if it's all the same to you, I'd rather you swallowed me down whole," which the elephant did. Now, after a while, the turtle got hungry, and he decided to scrounge around in the inside of the elephant to see what he could dig up for lunch. He blundered about till he came to a liver, and he pulled it off. And he saw a couple of kidneys, and he picked them off. Picked off both of them. But he wasn't quite satisfied. He needed something special, something for dessert. So he looked around, and he looked around, and finally he spied the elephant's heart, and he promptly began to nibble on it. The elephant said, "Turtle! Oh, turtle man, you kill me!" And it was true. The elephant fell over and died. The moral of that story is, don't swallow what you can't chew. Thank you. There is a favorite poem of mine, which I insist on doing, whether anybody wants to hear it or not. So since you're in here, and the doors are locked, I'm going to give you a little sample of this poem by Paul Laurence Dunbar. I think I did it last time, but that's all right. We can share it one more time, can't we? I hope. Well, one of the reasons why I like this particular poem is because, though it's a humorous poem, it has a great deal of truth in it. It was written about a time in the life of the Negro people before slavery was over. They were all still in slavery. Now, remember, the Negro had been brought to this country and denied any knowledge of his old culture. All of that stuff was taken from him. His drums were taken away. His stories were taken away. Everything about his past he was made to forget. Now, the only thing that he was able to latch onto was to the religion of the time. And he found great solace and satisfaction in the story of the Jewish people and in their deliverance from Egypt. And this particular story was the center of the religion of my people for hundreds of years. And it was their belief in this same deliverance, perhaps by the same Moses, that kept them alive. So although this story is humorous, it's based on a true situation. Now, in the time of slavery, it wasn't permitted to teach a slave anything except how to pick more and more cotton. Don't teach him how to read. Don't teach him how to write. Don't teach him how to talk. Don't teach him anything about religion except that part of religion which said, when you get to heaven, there'll be a place for you too. For instance, there was a lady, this is a real story, who said, she was talking to a young lady, she was a southern lady, talking to a young lady from the north. And the young lady from the south was talking, she said, "Oh, I had such a dream last night. So I dreamed I was in heaven, and I saw all my friends. I saw mom, and I saw daddy, and I saw auntie. I just saw all my friends there." And the lady from the north said, "Well, tell me, when you got to heaven, said, did you see any Negroes?" And she thought for a moment. She said, "No, but then I didn't go out into the kitchen." You see? So that this attitude that, you know, Negroes could only have that religion which would put them in the kitchen and in the cotton fields, even up in heaven, was the only one that we were allowed to have. But our people, as I said before, had a knowledge of Moses and of the Jewish people, of their deliverance. And when they got together, they would talk about these things
and wonder if these same kinds of things were not going to happen to them. Now, the plantation owners didn't want anybody talking about Moses and about coming out of Egypt. You could get your head knocked off by just talking about Moses in those days, you know, just really get it blown away. So this pastor that we're talking about had a problem on his hands. Now, he's got to get his people down to the edge of the swamp. He's got to preach to them about Moses and about deliverance, but he's got to do it in such a way that he can survive. You know, he's got to preach in such a way that if the old master comes up on him and hears him, he will think maybe he's kidding. Or if some of the slaves went back and told the old master what went on, that the old master still wouldn't quite understand what was going on. So you see, the preacher had a problem on his hands. But if understanding all of these things, still the minister had to tell his people about Moses and deliverance. So if we'll imagine that at the end of a hard day, when the slaves had got through picking all that cotton, and before they went home, they stopped on the edge of the swamp and listened to their pastor as he preached. And he went something like this. We've gathered here, my brothers, in this howling wilderness for to speak some words of comfort to each other in distress. And we choose as for our subject this. I'll explain it by and by. And the Lord said, Moses, Moses. And the man said, here am I. Now, old Pharaoh down in Egypt was the worst man ever born, and he had the Hebrew children down there working in his comb. Till the Lord got tired of his fooling and said, I let him know, look here, Moses, go tell Pharaoh. I said, let them children go. And if he refused to do it, I will make him rule the hour, for I'll empty down on Egypt all the vials of my power. Yes, he did. And Pharaoh's army wasn't worth a half a dime, because the Lord will help his children. You can trust him every time. And your enemies may sail you in the back and in the front, but the Lord is all around you for to bear the battle's brunt. They may forge your chains and shackles from the mountains to the sea, but the Lord will send some Moses for to set his children free. And the land will hear his thunder like a blast from Gabriel's horn, for the Lord of hosts is mighty when he girds his armor on. For fear someone mistake me, I will pause right here to say that I'm still a preaching ancient. I ain't talking about today. But I tell you, fellow Christians, things will happen mighty strange. Now the Lord done this for Israel, and his ways don't never change. And the love he spent on Israel wasn't all on Israel spent. Now I don't run and tell your masters that I'm preaching discontent, because I isn't. Oh, no. I was a judging Bible people by their acts. I'm a handing you the scriptures. I'm a giving you the facts. Of course, old Pharaoh believed in slavery. But the Lord, he let him see that the people he put breath in, every mother's son was free. And there's some that believe like Pharaoh. But the scripture calls them liar. For the Bible says a servant is a worthy of his hire, and you can't get round or through that, and you can't get over it. For whatever place you get in, this Bible too will fit. So you see the Lord's intentions ever since the world began was that his almighty freedom should belong to every man. But I think it would be better if I paused again to say that I'm preaching about our freedom in a Bibleistic way. But the Moses is a coming, and he's coming sure and fast. You can hear his feet a-tomping. You can hear his trumpet blast. But I want to warn you people, don't you get too brigadier, and don't you get bragging about these things, you wait and see. But when Moses with his power comes to set the children free, we will praise the gracious master that has given us liberty, and we'll shout hallelujah on that mighty reckoning day when we recognize as
citizens.
Children, let us pray. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That's always one of my favorites because the story it tells has truth in it, has humor, has truth, has history, and it relates even now to the struggle that we are waging. Dr. Martin Luther King is a preacher. It's not surprising that our great leaders are preachers. These were the only people we had to give us light and guidance in those dark days of slavery. And I was so pleased to see in the paper, just today I believe it was, that Dr. King had said that he called or was calling for negotiations in Vietnam because because how can there be freedom if there is no peace? How can there be brotherhood if there is no peace? And most of all, if you're going to talk about nonviolence, if you're going to talk about love, if it works in Selma, why can't it work in Saigon? There's no reason why it cannot. So, when I see a man who has made a name for himself purely in relationship to the Negro struggle, the civil rights struggle, when he begins to step out, when he begins to say what he sees, that there cannot be one struggle over here that is private and separate from everything else in the world, that it doesn't do us any good if Lyndon Baines Johnson says on one hand, we shall overcome, and then on the other, we shall overkill. He has to make up his mind. He has to do one or the other, can't do both. So I don't think we should give up on preachers after all. There's some good in the ministers yet. I'd like to sort of change my tempo a little and dedicate the following to the younger generation from Kendallin. It's a thing I've done here before too, and it concerns itself with baseball. And I'm sure you know what baseball is. If you don't, you will know during these 8 weeks. You'll have plenty of baseball in addition to the other wonderful things you're going to have here. Now, this is also a story about a great hero who had to meet the test, who had to meet the crisis, who had to go up to bat when everything looked exceedingly dark, and to do his all for his team. It's called Casey at the Bat. You know Casey at the Bat? All right. You know baseball? All right. Now, you can take sides if you want to. We haven't got anybody selling peanuts or hot dogs or pop. But just imagine that you're out at the ball game and that it's like at the Mets, you know. It's hard times. And it's like nothing is happening and everybody is anxious for something to happen. But the poem goes, if I remember correctly, something like this. It looked extremely rocky for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2 with but one inning left to play. And so when Cooney died at first and Burroughs did the same, a pallor wreathed the features of the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go, leaving there the rest with the hope that springs eternal within the human breath. For they thought, if only Casey could get a whack at that, they'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, and likewise so did Blake, and the former was a puddin' and the latter was a fake. So on that stricken multitude, a death-like pallor sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and the much despised Blakey tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had settled and they saw what had occurred, there was Blakey safe at second and Flynn a hugging third. Then from the joyous multitude went up a joyous yell. It rattled in the mountaintop. It thundered in the dell. It struck up on the hillside and rebounded in the flat for Casey. Mighty Casey was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the crowd, he'd lightly doff his hat. No stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes are on him as he rubs his hands in dirt. 5,000 tongues applaud it as he wipes them on his shirt. And then the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hips. Defiance burned in Casey's eyes. A sneer curled Casey's lips. And now the leather-covered sphere comes hurtling through the air, but Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. That ain't my style, said Casey. Strike one, the umpire said. From the benches, black with people, there went up an awful roar, like the beating of a storm wave on a stern and distant shore. Kill him! Kill the umpire! Someone shouted from the stand, and it's likely they'd have done it had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult and bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, strike two! Fraud! Cried the maddened thousands, and the echoes answered, fraud! But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain. They knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The smile is gone from Casey's lips. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel vengeance his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball. And now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this blessed land the sun is shining bright. Somewhere the band is playing and somewhere hearts are light. Somewhere men are laughing. And somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. Thank you. And now, for the last time, I'm going to do this one coming up this year. I am presently involved in the process of writing a play. One of the reasons I want to write another play is because everybody gets a little sick of the fact that I'm still doing the one I wrote before. However,
Since you are here and you're warm and you're receptive, you're very friendly, I'm going to close my segment of the show by doing a little piece from Pearly Victorious. I never tire of telling how Pearly came to birth, and I'm sure the older heads know it, but maybe the young people do not know that at one time I was stage manager for an off-Broadway production called The World of Sholem Aleichem. And I, of course, knew nothing at all about Sholem Aleichem, or Aleichem Sholem, nobody. They brought me in primarily because it was a cheap production and we had to bring in actors two at a time, you know, man and wife. They wanted Ruby to do the defending angel in Bunche Schweig, and so they gave me the job of stage manager so they could hire the two of us, you understand? So I went into the production, and I was amazed at what I saw. Now, I knew nothing about shtetls, Middle European culture, melamids, yarmulkes, all of these things, totally strange to me. And when I came into this theater and I saw on stage this world, this life, to which I was a total stranger, but opening up its heart and its doors and its warmth and welcoming me in, and I finding there all of the warmth and wonderful reception that I would have found among my own, my feeling of deep satisfaction and joy knew no bounds. And when I saw what was done by Sholem Aleichem with the warmth, wit, humor, and wisdom and folly of his own people in this form, I thought perhaps I could try and do likewise with my own wit, wisdom, and humor and whatnot. So I wrote Pearly Victorious. But suffice it to say, Pearly is about a young man who's a preacher also, who wants to go south to his home in Cochepi County to free his people from slavery on the cotton patch. Now, slavery is over, but his people didn't know about it. They were still working in old Captain's cotton field down on the cotton patch. Pearly wanted to go and rescue his people, and he needed $500 to do that. He was going to buy back a church that had been built by his grandfather called Big Bethel. And after three acts, he finally was able to get his church back with the help of his beloved. And at the same time, his enemy, the man who hated him, who had kept all of his people in slavery, Captain Cochepi, had died standing for what he believed in. Now, Pearly's first sermon in his church was also his funeral service for old Captain Cochepi, and it went something like this. Toll the bell, Big Bethel, toll the bell. Dearly beloved, recently bereaved, and friends, we welcome you to Big Bethel Church of the New Freedom for All Mankind. Part Baptist, part Methodist, part Catholic, with the merriness of Christmas and the happiness of Hanukkah. And to the first integrated funeral in the sovereign segregated state of Georgia. But let there be no merriments in these buryments. Though you are dead, old captain, and in hell I suspect as post-mortal guest of honor at our expense, it is not too late to repent. Why, we still need togetherness. We still need each otherness with faith in the futureness of our cause. Let us therefore stifle the rifle of conflict, scatter the patter of discord, smuggle the struggle, tickle the pickle, and grapple the apple of peace. This funeral has been brought to you as a public service. Tonight, my friends, I find in being black a thing of beauty, a joy, a strength, a secret cup of gladness, a native land in neither time nor place, a native land in every Negro face. Be loyal to yourselves, your skin, your lips, your hair, your southern speech, your laughing kindness. Our Negro kingdoms, vast as any other, accept in full the sweetness of your blackness. Not wishing to be red or white or yellow or any other race or face but this. Farewell, my deep and Africanic brothers. Be brave, keep freedom in the family. Do what you can for the white folks, as they indeed must do for you. And now, may the Constitution of the United States go with you, the Declaration of Independence stand by you, the Bill of Rights protect you, and the State Commission Against Discrimination keep the eye of the law upon you henceforth, now and forever. Amen. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you and good night. Thank you.
One second, please. I mean, there's no doubt about it. There's no question that Ozzie is not getting off. And we all know about it. And you're only out here for 10 minutes. That's all you know. You promised 20, remember?
Yes.
So you have 10 more minutes to go.
Okay. Why, thank you. You're very patient. I didn't know you would put up with all that stuff all this time. I have three youngsters of my own. One, Nora, is 14. Guy is 13. And Laverne is 8. So you can appreciate my problem, can't you? You understand what's going on, huh? Right. And we have many discussions around the table. And I try and keep the youngsters up to date on what's going on, you know, the struggle in the world, the cause, the picket lines, CORE, SNCC, SCLC. I want them to know what the score is, what's being put down. So I remember when Laverne was about 5 and things were hot and heavy down in Mississippi, and we'd been talking about the problem a great deal. So Ruby and I had to buy a new car because the old one just quit going at all. So we bought a car, and it happened to be a tan car. So we drove it up to the house. We got out. You know, you're always a little bashful driving up a new car into the neighborhood because everybody comes out to look as if you made the car yourself, you know, congratulating you and all this sort of thing. So we drove the car up in front of the house, and we got out. And Laverne saw us and came running out. And she said, Nora, look. Daddy and Mommy's got a Negro car. So we tried to explain to her that it didn't go quite that far, you know. One of the chapters in the Bible that I like, I think I read this to you before, but once again for the young people, it has meant a great deal to me, and I'd like to share it with you now. It's from the Psalms, and it seems that from the way I read the history of it, that when the Jewish people were being taken into captivity, they got to a point where they had to make a big decision about whether they were going to become like the people who had taken them into captive or remain Jews. So they sat down. I don't know if that meant a sit-down strike or not, but they sat down and they made a tremendous decision. And the decision they made is embodied in these verses. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, and we wept when we remembered Zion. And we hanged our harps in the midst of the willows thereof. For there they that had taken us captive ask of us a song. They that had wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth if I hold not Jerusalem above my chief joy. The beauty of those verses lie not only in the eloquence of the thought, but in the profound meaning, not only for the Jewish people, but for all people that are in them, that they chose, even in captivity, to remember who and what they were, to keep this as the center of their lives, even under pain of death. And having made this decision, they were then able to withstand everything that happened and still to live and function as a people. And this necessity of remembering Jerusalem, of keeping at our hearts all of the things that are dear to us out of our past, no matter what, is what gives all of us our strength, our character, our future. And if we have anything as individuals and as groups to give to mankind, it is in the area of remembering how we survived all that was thrown against us. The Jew in his long history of persecution, and certainly my people in the history of persecution for the last 300 years. What is the great thing that we can say about all this? We survived. And there was a reason we survived. We took it upon ourselves to deliberately not forget Jerusalem, to survive. And you coming to Camp Lakeland, to Camp Kendallland, you come not only because it's a summer camp, because there's fun and there is baseball, there are things to do and things to learn, but your being here also gives you an opportunity to participate in remembering Jerusalem. And therefore, your being here has all the more value to you as individuals and as youngsters, and to us older ones who will someday have to drop the torch and pass it on to you. And you youngsters, you. The future of the world, the peace of the world, picking up the mess that we have made is in your hands, in your laps. As a grown-up, all I can do is apologize for leaving you such an awful world. I'm sorry I couldn't do better. But you are going to have to make up for the mistakes that we made. All we older ones can do is to try and hold it together till you get here. And if we can, by picket lines and peace petitions and yelling and screaming and marching, try and keep the war whoop from our door long enough, maybe when you come along, peace and the beating of the plowshare from the sword will take place. Young folks, (clears throat)